Most people associate Philip Anschutz with railroads, but his start came in an even tougher business, oil and gas. It was in his blood. His father was in the business and taught him the needed entrepreneurial spirit well.
It's a business that you can take risks in. You have to take risks in. I might add, it's a business where almost by definition, being an independent oil and gas explorationist, almost by definition, you know that probably 95% of what you do will fail.
Welcome to the Rainmakers Podcast. In today's episode, we'll dive into the remarkable story of Philip Anschutz and how he earned his first $1 billion. This promises to be an engaging and insightful journey. If you appreciate my work, please consider leaving a review and subscribing for future episodes. As always, the sources used in this episode will be cited in the show notes below. Without further ado, let's dive into the fascinating world of Philip Anschutz. Philip Anschutz, a visionary investor, deserves our close examination. He achieved billionaire status by making strategic investments in industries facing challenges, and identifying hidden assets within undervalued companies, and finally, implementing effective restructuring. His journey began by assisting his father in reviving their oil drilling business. Subsequently, he ventured into the oil drilling, ranching, and real estate development in the Midwest. Despite facing significant early debts, a stroke of luck led to the discovery of a massive oil reserve, giving him a huge turning point in his career. Anschutz's knack for seizing opportunities and taking over industries such as railroads, cinemas, and sports venues through aggressive acquisitions paved the way for his wealth accumulation. He revolutionized industries by capitalizing on hidden assets through spin-offs, cementing his legacy as a multi-billionaire. In this episode of Rainmakers, we will explore the early years of Philip Anschutz. Philip Anschutz, born in 1939 in Kansas, grew up under the wing of his father, Fred Anschutz, who owned Anschutz Drilling Company. After graduating with a business degree in 1961, Philip joined his family's struggling business and relocated to Denver, Colorado. Due to his father's health issues, Philip took the role of president when the company underwent a transformation, becoming the Anschutz Oil Company. This experience marked his first foray into corporate operations and restructuring. In 1965, Philip sold his father's interest to Allied Chemical Company and established his own company, the Anschutz Corporation. Anschutz's education and early experiences in the oil industry significantly influenced his future business approach. He emphasized that oil drilling was a challenging industry where failures were commonplace. The capital-intensive nature of the business required constant borrowing, making success elusive. He recognized the importance of diversification as a defense against bankruptcy, leading him to invest in ranching, real estate, mining, and international oil trading. Anschutz's entrepreneurial spirit led him to explore various industries, and in his oral history, he once stated, "First of all, I was determined not to fail. I am aggressive and hardworking, and all of those things help. I was determined that the name Anschutz would mean something in the oil business. I suppose a lot of it went into the simple fact that a young man sometimes doesn't know what's impossible. Where more knowledgeable, experienced people would fear to tread, young people would sometimes move. I did. I was aggressive and I worked hard. Sometimes we didn't know what wouldn't work. We tried it and it did work." It's worth noting that he frequently mentioned being aggressive and knowledgeable in his oral history. This interview, conducted in 1974 when Anschutz was just starting, offers insight into his mindset. Before we explore his groundbreaking deals, let's clarify what he meant by being knowledgeable. Anschutz's company analyzed global investments and maintained international offices to seize opportunities worldwide. He recognized the increasing globalization of business, exemplified by a competitive bidding war with Canada's Oxford Group for some Denver real estate. Later, he formed a partnership with them for Denver property deals, acting as their local specialist. In return, he received a 30% share of their acquired real estate. Anschutz aimed to be well-informed within each industry and readily collaborated with other experts to pursue favorable deals. This perspective will be crucial as we examine his later ventures. Anschutz himself possessed a deep passion for gaining informational advantages, often delving into biographies of the pioneers who shaped the Western frontier. He even authored a book titled Out Where the West Begins, where he launched it in 2015, in which he paid tribute to his business heroes responsible for shaping the American West. In the book's foreword, he noted, saying, "The individuals selected were bold men of vision and considerable energy. They were able to accept the concept and the burden of high levels of risk. Most risked their reputations and capital, some even their lives. Yet all created companies or ventures that were innovative, productive, and contributory in some manner to the founding and expansion of the American West." Within this book, Anschutz eloquently described the pivotal industries he chose to explore, saying, "The key industries studied, many of which were already established but not yet established in the American West, were positioned to have the greatest impact. They were trading, farming and ranching, transportation, real estate, mining, manufacturing, and banking. The fact that these industries were interconnected is but yet another reason why entrepreneurs and businessmen were uniquely positioned at this particular moment in history to emerge as early contributors and leaders." Now, let's delve into some of the individuals who greatly inspired Anschutz. The first one on our list is Charles Goodnight. Charles Goodnight is a prominent 19th century American cattle rancher and pioneer who played a pivotal role in the expansion of the cattle industry and the development of the Goodnight Loving Trail. His contributions include introducing innovative ranching practices, including the creation of the chuck wagon, which improved the lives of cowboys during cattle drives. He also recognized the need to preserve American bison and contributed to the establishment of the Goodnight Loving Buffalo Ranch, dedicated to bison preservation. Goodnight also co-founded the J.A. Ranch, one of the largest and most successful ranches in the Texas Panhandle. Goodnight's enduring contributions to the cattle industry and Western expansion have an inedible mark on American history. Next on the list is Theodore Judah. Judah, a 19th century American engineer and surveyor, played a pivotal role in planning and construction of the first transcontinental railroad. His significant contributions include being the key architect behind the Central Pacific Railroad, a crucial segment of the first transcontinental railroad that linked California to existing Midwest rail lines. He conducted extensive surveys to determine the optimal route for the railroad, overcoming challenges posed by the rugged Sierra Nevada terrain. Judah actively promoted the concept of a Pacific Railroad and worked to secure the federal support for its construction. He played a pivotal role in advocating for the Pacific Railroad Act of 1862, which provided government assistance for the transcontinental railroads of construction. In 1861, Judah, along with other investors, founded the Central Pacific Railroad Company. He served as its chief engineer, contributing significantly to the construction of the western portion of the Transcontinental Railroad. Though Theodore Judah passed away in 1863 before the first Transcontinental Railroad's completion, his vision and engineering expertise laid the groundwork for the successful railway, eventually completed in 1869 in Utah. And next on our list, we have Adolph Coors, a prominent American brewer and businessman, best known for his association with the Coors Brewing Company. Here are the key highlights of his life and achievements. Born on February 4th, 1847, in Prussia, now known as Germany, Coors immigrated to the United States with his family. In 1873, Coors and his partner, Jacob Schuller, founded the Golden Brewing Company in Golden, Colorado, which would later become the Coors Brewing Company. Coors played a pivotal role in popularizing lager beer production and consumption in the United States. The brewery was renowned for its commitment to producing high-quality, cold-fermented beer. Adolph Coors implemented several innovations in brewing, including the use of refrigeration for brewing and storage. These innovations contributed to the brewery's success and reputation. The Coors family maintained control of the brewing company across generations. Adolph Coors' grandson, Adolph Coors III, became a significant figure in the company. And these are just three of the many people Anschutz would end up studying when he was learning about the Western frontier. Anschutz's in-depth study of these diverse businessmen across various industries who shaped the very regions where he lived and invested allowed him to grasp the significance of risk-taking, vision, and innovation. Anschutz applied these lessons to his own investments throughout his own career. His training, working for his father, and his deep fascination with Western pioneers provided him with a world-class education in risk-taking and contrarian thinking, enabling him to seize opportunities as they arose. Remarkably, five of the seven industries he extensively wrote in his book would become the pillars of his fortune. His early exposure to these industries and the insights he gained from the pioneers who built them served as the foundation for his bold and innovative approach to investing. Now, let's delve into his first deal that marked a turning point in his career. When the Colorado Historical Society sought individuals to interview for their project on influential figures in the state, Philip Anschutz, though only 35 years old at the time and not yet a major success, agreed to participate in order to share an inspiring story with his audience. He recounted a pivotal moment in his early business career, which would prove to be the most significant event in his life thus far. Anschutz began by describing a challenging period in his life when he had been in business on his own for just a year or two. Economic conditions were tough, and he was struggling to achieve success. During this trying time, he received a phone call in the middle of the night from his drilling superintendent, who delivered distressing news, saying, "The story I was going to tell you, I think probably the most important single event that happened to me in my business career so far, was shortly after I had been in business. I guess I had been in business on my own for about a year or two. I was having a very tough time of it. The times were tough. I wasn't very successful. It was economically a pretty tough and go situation. I had gone out to spend the weekend with my fiance in California. I got back in late on a Sunday evening and had gone to bed. About 2 o'clock in the morning, the phone rang, and the man calling was my drilling superintendent. He was calling to tell me that a well that I had a small interest in, that I was drilling for someone else, had blown out. In the oil business, that's an extremely serious thing. Many, many people are put directly into bankruptcy after such an event." Realizing the gravity of the situation, Anschutz initially took down the information and attempted to go back to sleep. However, a sudden realization struck him. This particular well was a wildcat drilling project, and it had blown out because they had struck oil. He immediately took action, summoning his chief geologist to meet him at the airport and renting an airplane. In the dead of night, they flew to Gillette, Wyoming, the site of the incident. Arriving in the early morning amid cold and windy and snowy conditions, Anschutz borrowed a car from the airport manager and headed to the oil well. Upon approaching the well, he could see that the oil was blowing out over the rig, confirming the gravity of the situation. Rather than getting closer, he promptly turned around and returned to town. By 8 o'clock, Anschutz had purchased several $100,000 worth of acreage from other individuals, fellow oilmen, and brokers. Multiple lease crews were dispatched into the field, working tirelessly to regain control of the well. Anschutz then flew back to Denver, where he faced the insurance company responsible for insuring the wells he owned. However, things took a turn for the worse. Not only was the blowout causing extensive damage, but Anschutz's insurer, Lloyd's of London, informed them that they would not cover any of the damages incurred by the well. In addition to these challenges, Chevron filed a $3.5 million suit against him after becoming an owner of one of the leases he ended up buying earlier that day. The situation escalated when, back in his apartment around 7 o'clock, Anschutz learned from the news that the drilling rig in Wyoming had exploded and caught fire. This was the same rig involved in the blowout, and the other operator in the well was accusing Anschutz of being solely liable, which could result in liabilities running into the millions of dollars. Their circumstances were dire. The well was not only spewing out oil uncontrollably, but was now on fire. Oil well fires were extremely dangerous, capable of causing even more damage to the surrounding area and emitting toxic fumes. Furthermore, extinguishing such fires was an exceptionally challenging task. In this critical moment, Anschutz had to take a decisive action to address the mounting crises. He reached out to the renowned oil well firefighter, Paul Red Adair, one of the few individuals with the expertise to tackle such a perilous situation. Simultaneously, he returned to Casper, Wyoming, to negotiate with the other owner of the well. I just want to back up a second and give a little bit of context here to what was actually going on. So the oil well Anschutz had was already causing a giant disaster with all the oil being spewed out. Usually the damage caused by that on its own is enough for someone to go bankrupt. But now it had gotten exponentially worse. Instead of just spewing out oil, this well was now on fire. Oil well fires were extremely dangerous. They can cause even more damage in the resulting areas around it and can release toxic fumes that could kill anyone nearby. But just as bad is just how hard it is to put these fires away. Now I want to give some additional context on who Red Adair was. Paul Red Adair was a legendary American oil firefighter known for his extraordinary skills in extinguishing dangerous oil well fires. Adair's career spanned several decades, during which he played a pivotal role in tackling some of the most hazardous and unsafe oil fires in history. Unsafe oil fires were prevalent in the oil and gas industry, primarily due to the volatile nature of these hydrocarbons and the complexities of drilling and production processes. Before Adair's era, these fires posed significant risk to human lives, the environment, and industry infrastructure. Factors contributing to the danger of oil fires included blowouts, uncontrolled gas releases, and a lack of effective firefighting techniques. Red Adair, along with the team at the Red Adair Company, revolutionized the field of oil well firefighting. They developed specialized equipment and techniques for capping and extinguishing well blowouts and fires. Getting someone like that to put out your oil fire was not cheap, and knowing that Andrews already had no cash, he was running out of options. So now let's zoom out for a bit. It seems to be a pattern for some of the best investors to face adversity early on in their careers and to find a way out of it. Just like I mentioned in episode 1 of Rainmakers, Richard Rainwater had early investing struggles as well. He chose to solve his problems by taking it upon himself to learn successful investing from the world's best investors. Another person that comes to mind is Chris Sacca, who infamously graduated law school $4 million in debt after losing all his money day trading on margin. Sacca's solution was to hustle his way to pay back the debt by moving to San Francisco, creating a fake consulting company, and finding ways to work with tech companies until he became an exec at Google. But just as a comparison to both of these stories, I think that Anschutz has them beat by a long shot. Not only was he in massive amounts of debt and on his way to bankruptcy, there could have been much worse damages that could have resulted from the situation. Just like Richard Rainwater and Chris Sacca, let's see how Anschutz managed to get out of this mess. In his oral history, Andrews describes his negotiations with the other partner in the well, saying, "We argued from about 6 o'clock in the evening to about 1 o'clock in the morning. I should say negotiated as to whose liability it was and who would do what in order to get the well under control. The final deal that was made was that I would assume total control in return for him assigning me a 1/8 interest in the well should I be able to get it under control. The man who owned the other interest in the well, Jeff Hawks, would agree to the deal on a written tablecloth that Anschutz would take full liability for the fire and damages in return for the interest in the well. He would then fly him and Hawks back to Denver, where he would see his well on fire, shooting out 500 feet in the air. He took on all the surrounding leases for $700,000 and now had gotten control of the well that was on fire. He had no money in the bank to even pay these leases and did not have the money to pay Red Adair to put out the fire. This is when he would go on a deal-making spree for the ages. He would sell both interests in the well for enough to put out the fire. He would negotiate with banks to go along with his deals that he made to purchase the surrounding leases. He won his lawsuit against Chevron and would later win another lawsuit against Lloyd's of London to pay off all the damages. And lastly, he would sell the rights to film Adair putting out the fire to a Hollywood studio that was making a movie on him as well called Hellfighters in 1968. Once the fire was put out, all the leases that he ended up buying had oil, and this would be the foundation of his business. What was Anschutz's lesson in all of this? He says in his oral history, "The point that I'm making is that you just don't learn that in schools. You have to have the initiative, be able to be pragmatic and tenacious, seeing all of the opportunity that could exist, and work like hell and not worry about what people think of you." This lesson just showed how being aggressive and knowledgeable really worked out in Phil's favor. Instead of finding ways to be defensive and working on trying to get his money back after his well had blown out, he viewed this as an opportunity to buy leases in the surrounding areas. Why did he do this? Since the well was blown out, it meant it had oil. This well would be one of the 25 that would strike oil. And remember, this was very important because with such a low success rate, if you could find oil, it meant you finally made some money. The only negative to all of this is that the oil was causing damage to not only his well. Spewing oil can damage the environment around it and lead to even worse environmental disasters like catching fire, which it subsequently did. But again, Anschutz looked at it this way. He discovered oil in one of his wells. If his well was spewing out so much oil for it to cause a disaster like it did, why not buy the other leases around this well and see if he could strike oil in the remaining areas? Everyone around him saw the negatives of the situation, while he focused on the single positive. There's oil in the land. And if he could clean it up, he can make a lot of money. It could have very well been due to his inexperience, but marching forward through all the doom and gloom ultimately allowed him to take advantage of the opportunity. While the liabilities for this could have easily bankrupted him, he already had that fate anyway, and chose to buy the leases from people who were more worried about their own liabilities than he was. He bought all the leases of the surrounding land from people who were happy to sell due to the damage made by his well. He did not care if one of those leases had a lawsuit with Chevron because he already knew he was in trouble from the blowout anyway. And now the well is not just blown out, it's on fire. But he kept going. He negotiated with the other owner of the well, who did not want to bear any of the responsibility of the fire and would simply sign that he would take on the full liability for his share in the property. So in total, what did Anschutz have? He basically had full liability on all the damage the well was doing to the areas he owned and the areas that were affected by the fire. He figured that by taking on all the risk, which he was taking on anyway, he would try to get as much of the reward as possible. All the moves Anschutz made gave him upside if things did work out. And because things did work out, he ended up getting leases that he knew had oil for dirt cheap prices while using the insurance and money he made from selling footage to Hollywood studios to pay off his expenses in the end. This deal would make him millions of dollars and would start the Anschutz company with him venturing out further into the other industries we mentioned previously, like ranching and agriculture and mining. Anschutz would use this deal to learn that by being aggressive and still going for the best outcome, he has a chance to go out on top. He leaves a parting sentence in his oral history concluding this saying, "There's always a point that if you go forward, you win. Sometimes you win it all, and if you go back, you lose everything." And that was that point for me. On that basis, everything that I've done of meaningful success has been done since that point. I was broke. I was flat. I was worse than broke. I was bankrupt at that point. From that, we've gone on to build a pretty good company. And this time, he did seem to win it all. He uses aggressiveness and optimism to take advantage of the opportunity, and having everything working out in his favor, it set him off on the path to being a big diversified company in oil, agriculture, ranching, mining, and trading. Now that we understand who Anschutz was and his first deal, let's move on to what would end up getting him on the Forbes list in 1982. The East Anschutz Ranch Deal. In 1978, Anschutz diversified his holdings to include coal and uranium mines, farms, ranches, and other real estate that potentially held value for oil drilling. Anschutz was quoted in Forbes talking about his investments saying, "It's all a risk, but at least it's a mixed bag." Drawing from his experience with the oil fire deal, Anschutz aggressively pursued deals that had the potential to be significant. While every owner thought their leases were worthless due to the damage caused by the fire, Anschutz saw that they had oil reserves beneath them that could effectively be drilled. Anschutz always looked for hidden assets that others might overlook. An example of this was when he was 27 years old. He negotiated a deal to buy all the Western art that the Santa Fe Railroad kept in its basement in Chicago. Anschutz would later donate this art, which is now worth millions of dollars. Anschutz owned ranches and other real estate across the Midwest to discover hidden values within each piece of property. His deep knowledge of the West and its pioneers who helped build it became a valuable asset for him. He noticed early on how interconnected ranching, railroads, and oil wells were. Railroad companies like Union Pacific, for example, were granted land by the federal government to build tracks and had often ended up with vast residual land around the rails. They would sell or lease this land to individuals for farming, ranching, or drilling for oil. Anschutz used this knowledge to purchase land previously owned by such railroads, looking for hidden values such as potential oil drilling sites. In a Forbes article, it mentions this saying, "Philip Anschutz, a history buff and owner of one of the finest collections of Western art in the U.S., inherited his father's instincts for trading. In 1977, a Phillips Petroleum geologist got a hunch that the southern reaches of the Overthrust Formation might yield oil and gas as it did in its northern section. Phillips wasn't interested, but Anschutz was. He hired the oil company's geologist and quietly bought leases on 8 million acres, mostly in Arizona. Since it was land no one else wanted, he only paid a dollar an acre. Then he began seismic testing and drilling a wildcat well. Chicago's People's Energy Corp. heard about it and bought a half interest. Then Phillips changed its mind and paid Peoples and Anschutz $25 million for a third of the property with a promise to spend $35 million more to explore it. If Anschutz wished, he could probably sell his interest right now, which was the year being 1981, for $5 to $10 an acre. This would be the blueprint of his big deal. One piece of land formerly owned by Union Pacific would make Anschutz his first $1 billion. In 1977, Anschutz bought a ranch that had been owned by Union Pacific and drilled by Standard Oil, where they had attempted to find oil but came up empty. He hired Amoco to use their new drilling technology to investigate further. They discovered one of the largest pockets of oil in the United States, with 3.4 trillion cubic feet of natural gas, 420 barrels of gas liquids, and 840 million barrels of crude oil, valued at $14 billion in 1981. Anschutz's 15% stake in this venture was worth $2.1 billion. In 1982, he sold half of his interest in the venture to Mobil Corp for $500 million. His vast knowledge allowed him to pursue deals aggressively and make him a billionaire. His instincts were driven by insights he gained from studying the history of the American West. After selling his interest in Mobil in 1982, he attempted to further diversify and engaged in deals with other known investors like Jay Pritzker to buy out public companies like ITT. After being unsuccessful, though, Anschutz returned to his roots in the West and began buying companies that were once owned by his heroes. This brings us to a series of acquisitions he would make in the railroad space. This will be our last case study on Anschutz for this episode because of how detailed it really is. And before we get straight into it, let's remember the things that made Philip Anschutz successful to this point. Number one, being aggressive. By being aggressive, he pursued big deals that others did not consider and would go forward even though there would be known risks. This became an edge for him in getting a lot of deals that made him a billionaire already. But number two, which was much more important, being knowledgeable. Because he knew the industries of the West like no other person, it gave him higher odds to succeed in the deals he did because he simply had an informational edge over his counterparties. With this informational edge, he would buy an asset and try to find a hidden and much more valuable asset like he did when he bought his ranches. These two qualities would ultimately help Anschutz when he jumped into his next venture, buying the Rio Grande Railroad. The Denver and Rio Grande Western Railroad was started in 1870 by one of Anschutz's business role models, William Jackson Palmer. It was one of the only railroads to connect most of Colorado, and after posting an all-time high in revenue in 1981, it had started to decline in both revenue and earnings when Anschutz would buy the railroad for $500 million. While we know that railroads have some hidden assets in their land, Rio Grande only had ownership in an office building in Denver and modest real estate in a few states. So why would Anschutz go for such a deal and potentially overpay for a declining asset? Well, first off, he did not actually put down the full $500 million in cash. Using his own company's assets as collateral, he would only put down $90 million of his own money and use the other $410 million as a loan to buy the company. Rio Grande had $200 million in cash, which he would use to retire half of the debt, and then use the train's assets to get a new loan of $210 million so that he is now free and clear from personal liability. So for his $90 million, he now owns a railroad that produces revenue in the hundreds of millions. Moreover, a significant deterrent for many was Rio Grande's dependence on the Southern Pacific Railroad, as it relied on their lines to connect much of the West for freight transport. At this time, Southern Pacific was merging with another big railroad that Anschutz dealt with before, Santa Fe Railroad. Santa Fe had their own lines in Colorado, and because of the merger, Southern Pacific did not need to use Rio Grande anymore. The hidden opportunity that Anschutz saw was making a move for Southern Pacific. He would notify the ICC, which is the regulating body for the railroad industry, on the anti-competitive action Santa Fe was doing to cause Rio Grande to potentially go bankrupt. In 1986, the ICC would then side with Anschutz and would break off the merger between Santa Fe and Southern Pacific. Using the Rio Grande gave Anschutz the ultimate leverage to then bid for and win the auction for Southern Pacific when he would merge the Rio Grande into it for the price of $1.8 billion. This would give Anschutz ownership of the fifth largest railroad in the United States at this time. Again, he would put down little to no money of his own and this time would not have to use his personal company as collateral. He got a $700 million loan from a bank in Los Angeles. He sold $200 million in bonds, $75 million in preferred stock, and sold Morgan Stanley 25% of Rio Grande's common stock for $111 million, covering the full equity amount to be paid for the purchase. You heard that right. He would end up owning the fifth largest railroad and put up no cash himself. In a little over 4 years, Anschutz turned his $90 million in Rio Grande to now owning 75% of Southern Pacific. But now the story gets even crazier. Southern Pacific was a big railroad and had a lot of real estate in many states in the West. To keep up with the big debt payments, Anschutz would sell off the real estate to pay off the debt while the railroad was struggling to operate at this time. Again, in this situation, like situations earlier in Anschutz's career, he was up against the wall. If Southern Pacific could not pay off the debt, he would lose his $90 million. But if he kept Southern Pacific alive, he could reap multiples of the $90 million he put down. By 1990, Southern Pacific was losing millions of dollars, and the value of the real estate that it owned went down to a point where Anschutz did not even want to sell because he thought the prices were too low. Morgan Stanley and the capital partners Anschutz brought along with him were worried that their investment would now go under. By 1992, he would finally sell off around $1.3 billion in real estate to cover the losses the railroad was putting out, but he was still not deterred. He told Forbes at the time, "I said in my original ICC filings that we would turn this railroad around. I'm in it for the long haul." This situation should sound a lot like the one he was in earlier in his career. And reading the article in 1992, one thing immediately makes that connection for me. It's when the writer wrote, "Does this guy enjoy headaches?" Anschutz still chose to go forward and was only looking at winning and not the downside of this deal. Morgan Stanley and his other financing partners wanted some way out of this deal and were desperate for him to do something to get their money back. But in 1992, when Forbes asked what he intended to do with the Southern Pacific, he simply said, "I might be a seller, I might be a buyer. It depends on who looks like a good dance partner." Anschutz saw the value of his railroad, and if he could turn it around, he would own a very profitable asset that will make multiples on his $90 million investment. But to do this, he needed to find a way to innovate the train line and hire an expert to fix the situation. Enter Ed Moyers. Ed Moyers was an operator of the Illinois Central Railroad and led its turnaround before he left to Southern Pacific. Moyers slashed the operating ratio at Illinois Central from 98% to 71%, while the stock tripled in 4 years with him at the helm. After hiring Moyers, Anschutz would use the strength of his name to take Southern Pacific public by selling 24% of the company in August 1993 for $390 million. Moyers knew how to operate a railroad company efficiently. At Southern Pacific, he cut 3,200 jobs, put 70% of the trains back in service, improved system-wide on-time performance by more than 50%, and sold 2,300 miles of short-line operations, and most importantly, dropped Southern Pacific's operating ratio from 96.5% to 91.7% within the first quarter. After the fixes Moyers would make, Anschutz would begin to sell some of the stock in his company and would net around $300 to $400 million. But after Moyers had some health issues, he had to retire in 1995, and Anschutz would then sell Southern Pacific to Union Pacific in 1996 for $5.4 billion, netting Anschutz $1.6 billion from the sale and 5.7% ownership of Union Pacific. But before he sold Union Pacific, Anschutz found his hidden asset that would make his original investment even more lucrative. He kept a subsidiary of Southern Pacific that was responsible for installing fiber optic lines along the railroads in the Midwest. Instead of just building the fiber optic network for other telecom companies, Anschutz decided to also build some for himself. He used the construction component of the company to lay the fiber cables along its lines for other telecom companies like WorldCom at the time. This netted the company called Quest $1.8 billion in revenue, which Anschutz would then use to lay their own fiber lines. Anschutz would then take this company public in 1997 and hire Joe Nachio to lead the company. Nachio was an executive at AT&T and was responsible for their consumer unit of the company. Nachio had the plan to make Quest one of the big players in the telecom industry, and would do so by aggressively buying out different internet service providers and then doing a $50 billion merger with US West to become a telecom behemoth. As the internet began to revolutionize the way businesses and individuals communicated and accessed information, Quest's robust fiber optic network became an essential infrastructure for delivering high-speed internet connectivity across the United States. As the dot-com boom reached its zenith in the late 1990s, Quest's value soared to unprecedented heights. The company's extensive fiber optic network was in high demand, making it a crucial asset for tech companies and internet startups that needed reliable and high-speed data transmission. Quest's stock surged reflecting the exuberance of the era, its role in facilitating the internet's expansion and serving as a backbone for countless online businesses, contributed to its astronomical market capitalization, reaching well into the tens of billions of dollars. Quest's success during this period was emblematic of the dot-com frenzy that swept through the financial markets, with investors betting heavily on the future of the internet and its potential to transform industries and society at large. This became such a big company that all over Forbes in the 90s, Anschutz became known as a telecom tycoon, and his older investments would just be a footnote. In 1999, Anschutz's equity in Quest amounted to $5 billion. He would only cash out in 1999 from this investment, though, after Quest sold 10% of the company to Bell South for $3.5 billion, with $1.6 billion going directly to Anschutz. In the early 2000s, the once prominent Quest Communications faced a stark reversal of fortune. The exuberance of the dot-com boom gave way to a severe downturn in the telecommunications industry, now known as the dot-com bust. The company's aggressive expansion strategy, which had contributed to its rise, began to unravel. Quest found itself saddled with a significant debt load, and its stock price plummeted as the broader telecom industry suffered a massive downturn. Joe Nachio, who had been hailed as a visionary leader during Quest's ascent, faced legal troubles and controversy during this period. In 2005, he was indicted on charges of insider trading and accused of selling his Quest stock while concealing the company's financial troubles from investors. The allegations centered around Nachio's alleged knowledge of Quest's deteriorating financial condition, which he had not disclosed to the public. In 2007, Nachio was found guilty on 19 counts of insider trading, and he was subsequently sentenced to 6 years in prison and fined $19 million. The case against Nachio underscored the corporate governance and ethical issues that plagued some companies during the dot-com era and its aftermath, as investors sought accountability for the corporate scandals that unfolded in the wake of the stock market crash. During the turbulent times faced by Quest Communications in the early 2000s and the legal troubles of Joe Nachio, Philip Anschutz, the founder and significant shareholder of Quest, had a somewhat different trajectory. Anschutz was not directly implicated in the insider trading scandal that engulfed Nachio. He maintained a degree of distance from the day-to-day operations and management of Quest, which was primarily led by Nachio. However, the declining fortunes of Quest did have an impact on Anschutz's wealth. As the company's stock price plummeted amid the broader telecommunications industry downturn, the value of Anschutz's holdings in Quest also significantly diminished. Philip Anschutz's train investments offers valuable insights into the significance of aggressiveness and knowledge in achieving success. Anschutz's relentless determination to transform the Southern Pacific Railroad, despite its staggering losses and deteriorating real estate values, exemplifies his aggressive approach to business ventures. Instead of shying away from the challenging situation, Anschutz remained resolute, emphasizing that he was in it for the long haul. This steadfast commitment to seeing his investment through, even when facing adversity, is a testament to his unwavering determination. Moreover, Anschutz's extensive knowledge of the railroad industry and his ability to identify hidden assets played a pivotal role in his success. He recognized that innovation and expertise were essential to turning Southern Pacific around. Anschutz strategically hired Ed Moyers, an experienced operator known for his successful turnaround of the Illinois Central Railroad. Moyers' transformative actions, such as reducing the workforce, optimizing train services, and improving punctuality, demonstrate how Anschutz leveraged his knowledge and hired the right talent to enhance the railroad's efficiency. Furthermore, Anschutz's ability to adapt and seize opportunities extended beyond the railroads. He astutely capitalized on the emerging telecommunications industry, leveraging a subsidiary of Southern Pacific to lay fiber optic lines. By expanding into the burgeoning field of high-speed internet connectivity, Anschutz demonstrated his knack for recognizing hidden assets and embracing technological advancements. This diversification ultimately led to the creation of Quest Communications, a telecommunications giant that propelled Anschutz to greater financial heights. In summary, Philip Anschutz's train investment saga underscores the importance of combining aggression with industry-specific knowledge to navigate complex challenges and uncover hidden opportunities. His unwavering determination, coupled with the strategic hiring and innovative thinking, transformed struggling railroads into lucrative assets and paved the way for his success in the telecom sector. Anschutz's ability to adapt and make calculated moves exemplifies his entrepreneurial prowess and serves as a valuable lesson for aspiring investors. In the end, Anschutz turned his $90 million investment in the Rio Grande Railroad into $2 billion by selling Southern Pacific to Union Pacific. He retained a 5.7% stake of Union Pacific stock and spun off the Southern Pacific's telecom division to capitalize on the internet boom, renaming it Quest. Anschutz sold another $2 billion worth of stock before and after the crash, bringing his total earnings from his $90 million investment to $4 billion. Leveraging his knowledge of Western businesses and risk-taking experiences from oil investing in his past, he became one of the 20 richest people in the country. This concludes our first episode on Philip Anschutz. If you enjoyed it, please leave a review and subscribe. Stay tuned for part two, where we delve into how he takes over the entertainment and theater industries. I look forward to having you guys with us for the next installment of the Anschutz series. See you guys next time.